As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, this is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. The last 16 of the Champions Cup is done and dusted. Northampton, Quins and Exeter are the English sides left standing. Leicester and Saracens were overwhelmed, although in very different matches, and it's the usual superpowers flexing their muscles elsewhere. It leaves us with a final rematch again as Leinster host La Rochelle. Harlequins travel to Bordeaux, Exeter play Toulouse and Northampton host the Bulls. The Women's Six Nations also returns this weekend and will name our God or Goddess of the Week. Loads to get through. Welcome back. I'm Alfie Reynolds and this week joined by the Times Deputy Rugby Correspondent, Will Kelleher.
Hello. Are you, Will? Flexing my muscles like the big dogs in Europe.
Is that right? You were at Quins Friday night.
Yeah, and went to the gym beforehand, hence why I'm flexing my muscles, yeah.
Makes a lot of sense, I can imagine. Also joining us this week is Elgin Alderman. Elgin, it was a Sunday trip to Northampton Munster for you at the weekend.
Yes, compared to Will, I'm the Challenge Cup, the physical embodiment of the second tier of Europe. But yes, Northampton Munster was just a classic European tie, sizable Munster support. Just one of those great occasions that when we think back to the old days of the H Cup, the Heineken Cup, this was the kind of match you think of. And it was, yeah, a brilliant game that Northampton just won out in the end.
Yeah, you mentioned kind of a classic game and a great game. A bit of a mixed bag maybe over the weekend. We'll come on to some of the issues with the Champions Cup later on in this episode. But broadly speaking, Will, what did you make of the weekend, the last 16?
I would have loved to have seen a bit more of Toulouse Racing.
Yeah, so explain just for people that
viewers in the UK may have missed the last 20 minutes because the TNT Sport feed dropped out. I'd been out and about on Sunday and recorded both games, so I was trying to avoid seeing what had happened in both of them, which I managed to do. Watched Northampton, which is brilliant, as Elgin said. And then Toulouse won. It got to about 20-something nil and about 50-odd minutes, and the feed dropped out, the screen went green, and then they did the "we apologise for loss of pictures" thing, so I started fast-forwarding my Sky Plus, and it never came back. And then in the bottom left of the screen, it said, "Oh, by the way, Toulouse have won 31-7, and they're now playing Exeter." So I will have to ask our guest later on the pod what actually happened in that last 20 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So coming up later on the pod, we'll be having a chat with Jack Willis, which I'm looking forward to. Bits of that game that I did see, he looks to be absolutely flourishing.
Yeah, and they've got DuPont back from sevens. They've got Roman and Tamak back as well. Like, we'll get onto it. But Exeter are having one of these seasons where they're batting above their average, and you feel like that's a hell of a test to go to Toulouse and win with all their uni kids and stuff like that, isn't it? I mean, they'll give it a go, but blimey, that's going to be a tough ask, isn't it?
And it is one of those things, isn't it, Elgin, with this competition, and it changes every year. And as I say, we will come on to it. We're having quite a good chat before we started recording with the three of us of how to solve the logistical issues and the structure of this competition and domestic rugby. But I still always get the impression, despite how it changes, despite the issues with the competition, it's still the cream that rises to the top. Now, Exeter and various others this weekend will do their best to have big, big upsets. But you feel like Toulouse, Leinster, La Rochelle, Bordeaux possibly as the outliers that are trying to break into that group, but we still get the best teams towards the latter stages every year.
Absolutely. I think one of the big things that we were talking about after the Northampton win is that they are now looking for potentially a double when so often the single proves beyond them, and the difficulties for teams to be fighting on two fronts. You see La Rochelle are willing to always give it a crack, and they came back from 16-0 down against the Stormers to win that game, so they were showing their European pedigree. But that ability, yeah, to fight on two fronts is something that a lot of teams don't sometimes want to do. You know, you look at Lyon, who are battling in top 14, they didn't seem overly bothered about their match against the Bulls in terms of the team they had put out. But yes, it's so difficult to fight on two fronts that's why you get the likes of Leinster and La Rochelle, who can field those big teams who are competing always.
But even those two don't win the league as well. If they've won, like, I think I talk about this at every point of this season in the last few years, but let's remind everyone, Leinster haven't won the European Cup since 2018. Like, they're always here, but they never win it these days. And they haven't even been winning the URC in the recent years either. La Rochelle haven't won a top 14 ever. So, like, it's hard. It's really hard. So Exeter would say they're on for a double two, but it's going to be brutally... Oh, and Quinns. But it's brutally difficult to win one, let alone two, as Elgin said.
It's when I was looking at possibly Northampton's fixture list. If they did go all the way in both competitions, it would be 9 successive match weekends from now, where about half of them are knockout playoff games. So, you know,
that's a great part of the year, though, isn't it? Like, we love this stuff. Like, we always feel like it takes ages for this competition to get going, but when it does, it is good. And like, it has changed a bit, where, like, I did a piece about the English challenges in Europe to tee up the weekend, and for it I spoke to an outsider, John Dobson, friend of the pod, and he was basically on the phone from Cape Town going, it's impossible for Lyon to beat the Bulls away. Like, 25 degree heat, 1400 metres above sea level, there's no way. And they didn't bring their best team, because they probably saw that themselves. So there are nowadays some results in the quarters, last 16, where you go, that's not going to happen, but there will be an upset somewhere, you'd expect.
Do you think? Because we always speak about
I don't
about
quite
it.
Know where.
Well, exactly. We always say, though, don't we, the home field advantage is so key.
Would you regard, maybe you wouldn't, because La Rochelle are back-to-back champs, but they've still got to win away in Dublin again.
I think that would still be an upset, though, wouldn't it? Particularly given the fact Leinster have already beaten them in the pool stages this year.
La Rochelle.
Yeah, in La Rochelle. And Elgin, I know you'll probably be able to speak to the form of La Rochelle better than me, but they've had some really good results this year, but they have stuttered and stopped, and it's been all a little bit tougher than you feel like it has been in previous seasons for them.
In the peculiar pool stages that is this tournament now, where you only play those 4 games, you don't play everyone in your pool, yes, La Rochelle weren't firing all cylinders. And when you saw them go, like I said, 16-0 down in Stormers, you did think, oh, this isn't the La Rochelle team that has won the past 2 tournaments. And yet they've just got so much muscle in that team that they just came thundering back to win by 1 point. And even then, if Manny Lebok kicks a quite kickable conversion, they would have been knocked out. But here they are still going. They do have the wood over Leinster in terms of these big knockout games, but like we've just said, Leinster have beaten them this year already at the Stade Marcel de Flange. So it will be a great occasion, and picking a winner is not something I'll be doing this week.
Yeah, well, fair. Will, you said you were chatting to John Dobson looking ahead this week. I mean, penny for his thoughts after that game.
So this time last year, I was lucky enough to go to Cape Town to watch Harlequins play in the last 16 against the Stormers. And on the phone, he was saying, I promise you, because there was a quite unlikely scenario that we could have possibly gone back to Cape Town if Leicester had beaten Leinster. Stormers had won 2, Stormers would have hosted Leicester. And so I was like, come on, get me down. And he was like, I will send you Western Province headed notepaper to get you down here. But unfortunately, it didn't happen. But yeah, Manny Lebok, it's brutal how sort of Mother Rugby comes back, doesn't he? Because he was the guy that won them the game in the pool with the last minute kick, and then he misses one from maybe even slightly easier position this time.
I think the conditions were harder, though, weren't they?
Yeah.
At the weekend.
But they're the first team ever to have won in South Africa as a European side in the Champions Cup, which is an amazing achievement. Like, and actually, there's a great stat from the stats legend Russ Petty, who is brilliant on X, who said 21 of the last 23 Champions Cup knockout games have been won by the home team in the past 2 seasons. And the 2 anomalies are La Rochelle winning and Leinster winning Stormers. So backing them to win away isn't maybe as difficult as it might have been for everyone else, basically. Yeah. They could be the one, because you don't expect that. I mean, we're already going ahead of ourselves a bit, but it'd be absolutely incredible if either Quinns or Exeter won in France.
It does feel with La Rochelle like they are just able to get their level high enough to win that match, because last year I was there when they played Gloucester in a knockout game at the Marcel de Flange, and Gloucester looked the better team for much of it and could have beaten them, and yet La Rochelle did just enough and then went on to win the whole thing.
But doing 3 in a row I mean, Toulon did it, didn't they, with their World 15?
Galacticos, yeah.
Would be absolutely extraordinary, wouldn't it? It's a bit like in the Champions League, isn't it? There was a stat for years that no one ever backed up winning the Champions League, and then Madrid did three in a row, didn't they, with Ronaldo and Bale and that team. But three in a row would be absolutely extraordinary. That'd be proper dynasty levels. And to be going through the best teams every time as well. Like, they're never getting an easy draw, La Rochelle, are they? They've had to beat Leinster away to win it last time. They had to beat Leinster the year before when they weren't fancied and never won it. And they're going to have to get them in the quarters again and then maybe beat Northampton or the Bulls and then win a final probably against Toulouse. So you think, blimey, or Bordeaux. Like, they would deserve it again, wouldn't they?
No, it would be absolutely extraordinary. Just very quickly on the Marnie Libok thing, it's something that always comes up with him, is it? That he is undoubtedly a brilliant attacking fly half. So many elements of what he brings to the game. But we saw it at the World Cup, Will, with that semi-final when he got hooked in the first half, didn't play a part in the final, and there were discussions around him for the whole of the World Cup.
Yeah.
Is his place kicking good enough? And as you rightly said, he's had some clutch kicks even this season already. But again, I feel like it's always going to be something that is a big talking point around him.
Yeah, it is brutal, isn't it? But there is going to be a point in the season in a knockout game where you're going to need to kick your goals. And like, we'll get on to Bath, but they lost their 10 and their 9 for a period and their 12 for a period at Sandy Park. And game management kind of lost them that game. It was so windy at Sandy Park and they just kept hoofing the ball up in the air and it was blowing back in their faces. And you just think, you need someone to go, what are we doing? Let's change the plan. The management of a game is really, really important. I sort of, in my heart of hearts, love the fact that we get to see these sort of more flair fly halves knocking around Europe. Like I prefer watching them than the sort of controlling tens, just in my heart. I know people are different, but that was a brutal blow. And there was also a funny old Finn Smith one, wasn't it, in your game, where he was blaming Alex Mitchell for holding the ball badly on the tee and hooked it horribly, didn't he, to the left.
It only just got over the bar from about 40 metres out, and he drilled it nice and low and wide, and immediately he just turned to Alex Mitchell and said, What's your finger doing? Your finger's doing rubbish stuff there.
It was a key point, that, as well, wasn't it? At that stage of the game.
Could have mattered, yeah.
It would have taken them, from a 5 to an 8-point lead. It would have taken them beyond the score. In the end, they scored. George Hendy scored that great try that took them clear anyway. But, having earlier missed that conversion in, again, the wind just had such an impact on kicking all weekend. It had a huge impact. But it didn't in the end.
So here's an interesting point, maybe. So I felt this watching Quinns and Exeter. Exeter have done this for years, and probably Quinns too, actually. Never taking the three. And you're thinking, there's no bonus points, lads. Like, you just win the game. Quinns in the first half on Friday turned down at least three kickable pens and messed up the line out. Like, the French referee, Trenini, was being very hot on really technical line out offences that were actually getting quite annoying after a while for both teams. So the line out was a bit of a... It was not a guarantee of scoring a try, but they were never kicking a goal. And it was a bit rainy on Friday at Quinns, but it wasn't as windy as it was everywhere else in the country. And then Exeter, every penalty is the tap-and-go thing, and they messed that up two or three times. They're not as good at it now as they were when they won the double with Sam Simmons and those guys. You think, I wonder whether there's a strategy change that has to happen in the quarters or the semis if they get there, because you can't be turning down 3, 6, 9... They would say, well, we back ourselves to get 7, but if you're doing that 4 times, that's hard. Like, you've got to kick your goals if it's the right weather, don't you?
It reminds me of all the conversations, again, going back to the World Cup that we were having, and it is different. You build a score, you look at what England did against Argentina.
You get no points for style in the quarterfinal, semi-finals of the Cup, do you?
Build a score, build pressure, but we'll see. Should we stick on the Quinns game then? So that kicked things off on Friday night. Good win for Quinns as much as it is a missed opportunity for Glasgow?
Oh, yeah. All things are true. Like, I couldn't believe it. Glasgow, so they gave away 12 penalties in the first half, which is an insane amount. And it was, I think, 12-2 count at half-time. Quinns dropped one over the line. They butchered three chances as well as that to score. Glasgow shot themselves in the foot massively. They scored with pretty much the first attacking phase of the game, which they went through 15 phases and scored, and then didn't have the ball for the whole half because they kept giving away penalties. And then they got themselves back into the game, and Quinns did that classic thing. So Quinns used to be the team that were miles behind and scored 4 tries and then won. Now they're the team that score 4 tries, get ahead, and then let the other team back in. It wasn't quite that extreme this time, but they gave away two tries within 2 minutes after half time. All that good work of the first half completely undone. And then actually, to their credit, when Joe Marler went off with the sin bin, their defensive stand won them that game, because they had 10 minutes where they didn't concede, defended very well in their own half, and then scored the vital try when he was back on the rolling ball, Sam Riley, 5 minutes to go, 4 minutes to go. But Quins are just such a maddening team to watch. Like, they're so mentally fragile. It's unbelievable. Like, I can't see them. Maybe I'm going to be proven wrong, but I can't see them having the sort of minerals to win something this season, because they can't go through these long phases of matches where you just concede multiple tries. It's incredible.
But do you think all this is getting us onto the Premiership running? But I would say outside of Northampton, who broadly speaking have been consistent, all the teams have displayed
you're
that.
You're right. And maybe that changes in the semis or the final, but maybe it doesn't. But you just think it's sort of an anomalous year this year in English rugby, because there's sort of no tight team. There's no kind of eke it out team. Everyone's just thrashing each other and scoring loads of tries.
It's a lot of basketball.
Not defending
scores,
very well.
There?
But yeah, on your point about Glasgow, they will kick themselves. Like Quins, they never won a top tier champion / Heineken Cup tie. So someone's always
knockout
had to go.
Tie.
Yeah, knockout tie, yeah. But yeah, they probably should have won that game.
I do wonder how our friend and colleague Mark Palmer and his drive back up to Scotland on Saturday.
He went back
morning.
And did the Old Firm. He did Rangers Celtic.
Did he? Well,
on
that was
Sunday,
that was a mad game as well, wasn't it?
Well, you know why Glasgow lost? It's because they took the points. And then they only went 3-0 after Harlequin scored the try.
True. Yeah. But no, I don't know. Like, there was a big thing in the week. So we were chatting with Danny Wilson, who obviously was sacked by Glasgow 2 years before, and he was making no secret of the fact that he wanted basically personal revenge for them getting rid of him. And he was making a big deal of the fact that Glasgow have a huge budget, much bigger than theirs. We think it's around £9 million, which is incredible. I was saying to Mark and our Scottish friends on Friday, how the hell have they not won anything? £9 million. A French salary cap's €10 million, is it, Elgin? Roughly?
I wasn't aware they had one.
They actually do have one, though, don't they, in France? But and they're sort of, when you see those graphs that are like, the French budget is this, it's not actually what they spend on their salary, it's the budget for the whole operation. But yeah, roughly €10 million is the French cap. English is five at the moment, going up to 6.4. But Glasgow's spending £9 million on their team, and they've not won a dot since 2014, Pro 12, isn't it? And they had 14 Scottish internationals, which
I was going to say,
it's
a team of internationals.
The whole Scotland
back
row, which Will Evans had in his pocket largely for that game. Like,
he's had an unbelievable season.
Yeah,
with Evans,
really good. Yeah. And actually afterwards, Danny Wilson was like, I don't know why he's not had a chance with England. And obviously the answer is England have got quite a lot of really good back rowers. But he's just got one of those very specifically brilliant skills at jackaling, hasn't he? The sort of Jack Willis thing that
I was going to say, particularly with England losing Jack Willis.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's the most obvious replacement in terms of the
jackal stats. So ridiculous.
Yeah.
He's always miles ahead of everyone on that front.
And Harlequins' reward is a trip to Bordeaux, which brings us nicely onto them. I said earlier, Elgin, of, you know, maybe Bordeaux could be the team to upset the Toulouses and the Leinsters and the La Rochelles. They look, I think, the closest of everyone else of who could win it. Are they genuine contenders for the whole thing?
I think Bordeaux v Harlequins is the perfect matchup for just what should be a very silly, exciting game of rugby. I think I was joking before we came on air that Bordeaux have beaten Saracens by a combined margin of 100-27 this season. And if a French team had done that away from home, you'd be questioning whether or not they were trying. I'm sure Saracens, of course, they were trying. But they were just blown away on both occasions by just an absolutely thrilling back line that was just absolutely purring. And on the weekend, they were without Mathieu Jalibert, and Matteo Garcia came in and was man of the match. And then you just go through the guys they've got outside him, and it is, by and large, who's been playing for France recently. Deportaire, who made his debut, Moafana inside him, BLBRA and Penno on the wings, who are both just great as well. Luku inside him. And then the fullback, Romain Buros, who's a great player as well, even though he doesn't get French recognition. That's not to say that they don't have, you know, Steele up front as well, with Big Ben Tammy Funer, who is just probably everyone's favourite tight end prop, surely. But they do have some great Steele out wide. They are just absolutely thrilling to watch. I was there in Bordeaux when they beat Toulouse in the Top 14 a fortnight ago. That was a thrilling occasion, and they were just brilliant then as well. So you are looking at them as perhaps one of these new teams that could go all the way. And I think, you know, at the Shab and Delmar against Harlequins, I'd be surprised if Harlequins beat them.
And if they win, they're probably going to play Toulouse. So it's basically, can they beat Toulouse, isn't it?
Like, if they did 2 weeks ago. Yeah, but that was, I suppose, with Dupont different. At 10, they've got Antimac back now, and it's a semi-final, so it is slightly different.
Oh, this is cool. It's fun to see different teams getting in, isn't it?
Just fight one on Saracens off the back of this game. We've got loads of other stuff to get through, but I just wondered, there's been a few results, hasn't there, in the Champions Cup over the last few years that where Saris haven't been the Saris of old. We know that. I just wondered whether, particularly when you throw in the context of the departure of Farrell at the end of the season, the fact that Mark McCall has felt like it is kind of time where some of these players are moving on. Was this almost the final nail in the coffin of Saris in Europe? They are not the team that could once produce the sort of results that saw them be absolutely unbelievable.
They don't have the squad. And there was a reason why they had the squad before and they don't have it anymore. And they've stopped doing that and so they don't have the squad anymore. Like, that's kind of sums up the English challenge, doesn't it? Like, that was sort of some of the theme of the piece I was writing before this weekend of, okay, so there are more Premiership teams left than there are any other league, and that's still the case, with, well, three equal from France and Prem now, with two URCs. But you think, yes, but they're not going to actually win it, though, are they? Because they probably don't have the depth. Like Elgin's saying there, like Northampton have got to go 9 weekends in a row with major games to win the double. It just doesn't seem possible. They don't have the depth chart that France, the French teams can have, where they're losing their French number 10, but the next guy comes in as man of the match and is brilliant. Like, they don't have that anymore. And we know that for a long time, Saracens were breaking the salary cap, and that meant that they had an inflated squad and could compete at the top end of Europe and win it. It's maybe unfair to bring back up, but that was the reality, wasn't it? And they don't have that anymore. And it's going to be interesting with the Farrell thing, because he's now injured for a quite vague number of weeks, in inverted commas, which wasn't made clear after the Northampton game, where people asked whether he was okay and they said he was, and then fitness update on Tuesday didn't yield any information on his injury that then turned up on Friday afternoon. So he's ruled out. So he might miss quite a lot of his final matches as a Saracens player. So we'll see how they do with that. I mean, Saracens probably still can end up winning the league, because, as we said, does anyone have the steel that they've got in those Prem games? But yeah, it has felt for a while that we've been closing the curtain on the Saracens era, and that was another draw, I suppose.
Let's rattle through a few of the other games, because we've got loads more to get onto. Elgin, in terms of Exeter-Bath, as we've spoken about already, the conditions were unique, particularly unique down there at Sandy Park. That wind was just blustery all over the place, made it pretty tough for both of the sides. Bath also with injuries, Finn Russell going off early, the 6-2 bench split not working out for them. Great win for Exeter, though, particularly when you consider that even though they, in theory, at halftime, I was watching it and thinking, well, I feel like they've had the wind here. They haven't gone in at halftime leading. Surely Bath now are going to be able to pull away. For Exeter to be able to hang on in there, another incredibly noteworthy result for this young Exeter side.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming from 15-7 down, they were at one stage to win that game with the tries from Ethan Roots and Greg Fisselau. We've spoken in the past on this podcast about the difficulties of dealing with all these young players. You know, as Will knows very well, Ross Vincent still has designs on being a pizza delivery driver when he's not running in tries from Alfie Barbary's dropped kickoffs. And yet they still do show that there is just within them that ability to win important matches, even if they can roll over as they did against Sale the week before in the Premiership. But when I was reading the Times match report of this match on Sunday, and I was just looking at the tackle stats that came out, and I think Bath had to make 272 tackles or something. So it was almost one of those, even though new Exeter players, one of those classic performances of Exeter just forcing opponents to make just heaps of tackles. And then in the end, it did tell with that try to win by 6 points. I just want to say, on the Bath note, the highlight of the game, undoubtedly for me, was Ted Hill galloping in from 40 yards. Because even though he is... it was a blindside flanker. It was very much, you know, locks in open field, which is one of the great things when you see big gazelles galloping downfield. And, you know, Emmanuel Faye-Wabosa, who was outstanding in close contact making yards, he didn't have the wheels to catch him.
I didn't realise Ted Hill was that quick.
Oh, so you know what? I remember in the season where Leicester were terrible at Welford Road, they got hit by 40 by Worcester, and Ted Hill was incredible. And that day, I remember being like, who's this guy? Like, he scored two tries. He quickly got the nickname Super Ted. And I've interviewed him once a while back, and he's a lovely lad. I think he said his dad's was a quite hard-nut policeman. But he's not that character. He's a very nice bloke, and he's sort of this Clark Kent who has the big black ring glasses and takes them off, and he's just amazing. Like, it's been a shame for Bath that he's been unfit all season, but they've not necessarily missed him because they've got so many good back rowers. But yeah, he's quick.
And this is why, working off something I think Caden Murley said a few weeks ago, because we've suddenly got into 40-yard dashes because of Lewis Rees Summit, it would actually be really interesting to see rugby players do things like the 40-yard dash, because not only Ted Hill, but Tom Ahern, the Munster lock, he did a great gallop down the touchline. Southampton, Chip and Chase as well. And the man covering across was Curtis Langdon, a hooker who then broke downfield. So, you know, it'd be great to see.
Combine.
Great to see the locks doing a 40-yard dash. Yeah. I think we'd all pay to watch that.
On the Exeter one, I'm just quite enjoying their whole story of basically ripping up and starting again and kind of still achieving the things they were before. Like, they made the semi-final last year with their kind of 1.5 team, and now it's the 2.0 team. And Rob Baxter sort of predicted this when we were asking about it before. He was saying that doubling up is the really hardest thing to do in rugby. So he was talking about the repeat fixtures, so like Bordeaux Saracens that had already happened in the pool. But he was saying, like, look, if we end up going to Toulouse, this was 10 days ago, everything would say that Toulouse would give us a good old humping, was the phrase he used. But we'll have 50 minutes in that game, I guarantee it. It'll be interesting to see what we can do in those 15 minutes. He was like, every French team, no matter how good they are, give you 15 minutes. So can you win the game in that 15 minutes? And it'd be remarkable if they did, but let's see.
Maybe that brings us on quite nicely to Leinster-Leicester as well, actually, because that was the game that I think, out of all the others where you maybe weren't necessarily sure of the results, maybe Bulls, Lyon, we were a bit certain on, but Leinster-Leicester, I think generally people didn't give Leicester too much of a chance there. And even though in the end, 36-22 to Leinster, I think it was a much better showing from Leicester, particularly with some of the injuries they had in that team than people were expecting.
Leicester covered the spread. So it was 16 points. Leinster were favoured and they got to 14, so better than usual. Which I don't know whether that plays to Leicester's grit and the fact that they did better than expected, or the fact that Leinster maybe aren't quite as vintage as the vintage teams that they've had that haven't actually ended up winning stuff. But you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I have seen people saying that. I think it was a bit of both. I think it's one of those where Leicester clearly came in with a game plan, executed it fairly well, fought for everything in really trying circumstances, and Leinster, and I've seen quite a few Leinster fans say this, that they're just weren't quite as good as they maybe could be.
And Leicester clearly missed Chesham and Martin particularly, didn't they? But yeah, they're an interesting one. Leicester, like, they don't have an attack coach, as Dan McKellar was saying, and haven't been able to get one this season, which looks like it on the pitch. They're, what, seventh in the Prem and out of Europe, and you think maybe a slightly bigger rebuild, possibly post-Borthwick than expected.
Right, let's just finish off then Northampton-Munster. You said already of what a great occasion it was, Elgin, but one of the things I was going to ask you was it as fun as it felt like it was watching it on TV? You've already said a match which felt like a good old-fashioned classic Heineken Cup tie.
Certainly the first half, you know, it was the Lord's hum amplified by 10. There was just constant noise, unrelenting pace. There was a huge travelling Munster support there that were very vocal. And a lot of the time it sounded, you know, just as Irish as it was English watching that match. And it was, you know, both teams going at it, you know, right roll, ding dong. You know, Northampton opened the scoring, and then Munster come back with two, and then Northampton score to level at half time. There was then a bit of a sort of 20-minute lull in that third quarter as both teams were struggling to get into the red zone and not give the ball away, not give penalties away, etc. And then in the final quarter, Northampton just ripped it open first with, you know, a cracking 80-meter team try that was just typical of the crisp running lines that they have in that back line, and a mixture of long and short late passes as well to combine to send George Hendy over in the corner. And then that winning score, which was just all about George Hendy, that long ball from James Rahm that bounced behind him, and you thought, okay, he'll just set it up here on the wing and Northampton will go again. But he stepped Jack Crowley in and fended off Simon Zeebo to go over in the corner. So, you know, it was a great moment for the 21-year-old coming back. It was only his second appearance since December. I think he made quite a few waves early in the season, had a bit of an injury, and he's coming back now. And, you know, he'll be remembered as the match winner, even though there were some great performances throughout the team.
Northampton's defence still, though. Like, they held Munster a couple of times there, didn't they? That's been such an obvious improvement this season under Lee Radford, the old rugby league guy. Because they always had the great attack and they've always been able to score tries, but they kept conceding loads. And that massive improvement has been defence. And some of that win was built on that as well.
Yeah, stuck in the game, didn't they? Under quite a lot of pressure in that first half, but found a way to get the job done.
Yeah. I do like Hendy also, no, you would, but just looked like he was having the best time scoring that try as well, going like, oh my God, I've just scored that try kind of thing, which is really fun, isn't it? When you see someone having one of their best days and really enjoying it, it's just quite heartening, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So the quarterfinal lineup: Leinster, La Rochelle, Northampton against the Bulls, Bordeaux, Harlequins, and Toulouse against Exeter. And Toulouse, without question, one of the most impressive sides, I think, over the last 16 weekends. So coming up next, we're going to have a chat with the Toulouse flanker, Jack Willis. Well, Jack, thanks so much for your time. It's great to see you and we appreciate you joining the podcast. How are you feeling today? Heck of a win in the last 16 into the quarterfinals.
Yeah, buzzing. Thank you, mate. A little bit sore, but no, we were chuffed yesterday. It was a tough game to start the sort of qualifying rounds off, and yeah, another tough one to come this weekend in Exeter.
One of the big things I was thinking about, Jack, is how we always chat about European pedigree when it comes to the Champions Cup, and Toulouse are one of the sides that are most synonymous with it. I wondered whether that's something that, as a player, you actually feel. Is it something you're aware of, or is it something that more gets spoken about outside the club?
I think in terms of previous success, it's probably spoken about more outside the club. I think for us, we believe we've got a group that could compete in this competition. There's some incredible teams in the. I was looking at the down to the last eight. There's some really strong teams still in the competition, and one being Exeter this weekend. But I think for us, we want to sort of be part of the history and make our own history as a group, and that's something that is spoken about internally. Like, what can we go and achieve ourselves? This group, this people in this circle, really. And I think that's one thing I love about Toulouse, is the ambition to win games and to try and win trophies.
Jack, can you tell us, what is it actually like playing for Toulouse? Like, it's such an iconic team, isn't it? It's basically like Real Madrid of rugby, isn't it? With as we've talked about, the history. As an Englishman playing over there, like, bring us your postcard from Toulouse, I suppose. Like, what are the sort of sights, sounds and smells of playing for them? Because it seems like such a dream club to play for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair comment. Look, when I first came out here, I think I was a bit blown away with the support that you get each week. Just the standard regular league match that obviously has a lot on it, but it's not the biggest game in the world. It's not got the masses of meaning necessarily. It means the world to us, means the world to the fans. As a club, every single game feels like a European game. It feels like those games that you build up for, and the fans, the passion, you hop off the bus and you've got people screaming at you. You have to be grateful for being part of a group like this and being part of a team like this. And I think going back to sort of my past, couple of big injuries, everything that happened at WAS, I really do try my best to take in each weekend and each game that we have and be grateful for it, because it really is incredible. And I had a lot of my family out here this weekend for the game. It's just such a nice feeling coming off the pitch, obviously with a win, and there's a buzz anyway, but talking to them and just hearing them just being like, it was just incredible. We're sat in the stands, the drums, the songs, and like, and hearing that, it adds to the whole experience. It's not just us out on the pitch, it's everything that goes on around it, and the passion is, yeah, it's hard to put into words, really.
What are the sort of very different things about playing for Toulouse than playing for Wasps? I'm thinking the sort of very stereotypical stuff about French rugby, where everyone turns up in a really smart suit and a pressed white shirt and stuff. Like, do you get, at the start of the season, do you have to go to some hangar somewhere and they go, right, this is your gear that you turn up in?
we do get given an incredible amount of kit, which is, yeah, as much as my missus is like, well, where am I meant to put all that? She's not quite as happy as I am when I get all the kit bag at the beginning of the year. But yeah, we get looked after well here, and I think we feel a responsibility to as you spoke that question up earlier, around sort of the talk around the history of the club. I think it is there that we know it. We know it's there. We know what other groups have achieved. And I think we feel a responsibility to make sure we're giving it 100% to add to that.
The last time I did a Toulouse game, it was actually a defeat, was when Ulster went there and Robert Balakoon scored a hat-trick, and it was at the football ground in the island, the river, rather than the rugby ground you played at on Sunday. And we were actually giving our rugby writers award to DuPont for winning like the best player of the year for 2022. And where we gave it to him is it was one of the most like French scenes I've ever seen. It was in the hospitality where they had like Iberican ham and cheeses everywhere. Didier Lacroix was knocking around the president, like taking him off to talk to the right people. Like, is it a bit mad when you have to sort of pinch yourself going like, God, this is a bit different gravy up here.
Yeah, the after-match stuff is crazy, to be honest with you. You're walking around, we walk through sort of the fan, there's like a little fan zone you walk through to get to the family area to catch up after the game. And there's just, yeah, like you said, hams, cheeses, food, red wine flowing. And I think there is one area there where it's sort of all you can eat, all you can drink, once you've bought your ticket to get in there. So you can imagine that goes on. That is one thing that's very different. I remember being at the Rico, like by the time we've got out of the change room sometimes, they would have shut the bar so no one would be able to get a drink. Whereas here, they're still drinking about 12 hours later at the stadium. There's actually a place called the Bodega, which stays open till about 4 in the morning. So I think, yeah, I think people, when they watch the game, they make the most of that in the entire evening.
And like on that sort of pinch yourself thing, like you're playing at the same level as them, so I'm not saying you're starstruck, but when you're in the team with like Roman Intermac coming back and DuPont coming back from sevens and stuff like that, are there still stuff that they do in training or in matches where you, I don't know, you take your head up after the back of a breakdown, you're going, wow, like you're even impressed kind of thing?
Yeah, it's certainly a nice feeling when, off the back of a dominant scrum, you've got those two running at 9 and 10. I think it's great to see Roman back after such a tough injury as well. I think I'm not sure if you caught his first game back against Poe, but he just came back, looked sleek, classy, like he had so much time on the ball. And it's great to see how hard he's worked. It's a credit to him that he's put himself back in that position, ready for a big game against Racing and hopefully be ready for this week as well. I think having guys like that in your team is impressive. And I think there's certainly moments in training where they can be a little bit more jouer, as they say, and let loose. And there's certainly some skills they pull out that I know that I couldn't.
And where do you feel your rugby's at the moment, Jack? Do you feel you're playing your best stuff? Like from afar, it seems like you're really thriving over there.
Oh, thank you very much. I go through my games and there's always things that I'm wanting to work on and improve on. I'm really enjoying my rugby. I've worked really hard since coming back this season to try and free myself up before each game and not put too much pressure on the way I'm trying to play or how the game's going to look, and just try and bring the best version of myself, work as hard as I can and sort of see where that takes me. I think that's probably one thing I've learned playing for Toulouse is you can't expect where a game's going to go at all. You can't predict it. That's what makes it so exciting, the way we play. Yeah, you could be defending for long bouts and all of a sudden there's a counter-attack and we score from our own 22. You've got to be ready for anything. And having that sort of open mindset, I feel like something that's been a positive change for me.
And is that something that's a difference to when you were playing in England?
I'd say so. I think, I don't know, where I can't sort of speak for the rest of the teams in France, but I think we certainly have a mindset of playing what you see. And keeping yourselves free to not just stick to the structure, to play what's in front of you. And I definitely feel that's something that I've loved at Toulouse and do love week on week, because it's exciting to watch, but it's just as exciting to be out there on the pitch playing it.
Is there a part you'll get, like the English fans that would have watched you for years at Wasps and with England, who maybe don't see you as much these days because it's not on the telly as much and all that? What's the thing that you've added to your game, you'd say? And we all remember that the Jackal was the big thing, wasn't it? But you've obviously got more to your game than that. But has there been something you've been actively working on since you came back from that injury that ruled you out the rest of the World Cup that has got you back in?
I'd say that playing for Toulouse, you've got to add to the attack, the attacking system. And I think realising the skill level of the boys in the team with their handling, their offloading, I always go through my games with my dad and talk to him about things, and we quite often laugh at how much how much more I pass the ball playing for Toulouse. I reckon I pass them more in one game for Toulouse than I do in a whole season when I was back at Wasps. So I think that's part of sort of releasing some of that pressure of like, oh, I must just carry, not make a mistake, to actually, you know what, let's play, and you're encouraged to play here and express yourself. And yeah, if mistakes are going to happen, but as long as it was the right decision, you can work on the skill level to get the execution right. And I think that's something that's really positive that's driven here.
It sounds like, and not trying to put words in your mouth, but both on and off the field, it's been quite freeing. Like, we know, and you've talked about it a lot, that the heartache of the Wasps situation, but maybe also the clarity that you've got, whether you agree with it or not, about the England situation. It sounds like, you know what, I don't know, you're freed up on the field, but also you're having such a good experience off it too. Are you feeling that you've got this freedom in both senses?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really fair point. I think it would be hard if I clung on to the fact that I couldn't play for England constantly. It would make me incredibly frustrated. I love playing for England. I have loved playing for England. I would like to play more for England. I'd love to do that. But I think understanding your reality and the reality you live in, if I play in France currently, the rules states that I can't play for England. So it does free you up, because that's the situation. Accepting what is ahead of it in what accepting the position you're in, I guess, and it frees me up, because I can just go out and concentrate solely on my job each weekend for Toulouse. And what I love about playing here is every single week, you're waiting for that team to come out, and you don't know whether you're in the squad or not. We normally pick the changes up sort of where in the week they name the squad. But the competition in the back five, well, competition everywhere in the squad, but for me specifically, the competition in the back five, a lot of players that can play second row and back row. And each week, you've got to be at your best to be playing in the team. And I love that. I enjoy competing in training, the intensity of training, and Being out here, a lot of the time the training sessions are in the sun instead of 2 degrees and the rain coming in sideways, which I can't complain about.
Did you it ended a bit abruptly, didn't it, the World Cup for you? Did you find that all just quite frustrating that was the last time you played for England for a little while, that you got your injury, you had to go home, you hadn't played loads of the games? How would you sum all of that up?
Oh, look, I was gutted the way the World Cup ended. I think as much as I was frustrated I wasn't playing more, you have to understand the situation, where the decisions that are made, they're made. But I really want to make sure that whenever I'm in an England environment, I was adding to it, and I could feel the way the team was heading towards the back end of the tournament. There was some big games to come, and as you could see, it sort of nearly went all the way. You never want to have that cut short through injury. I know I hadn't played masses throughout the group stages, but I wanted to stay there and compete to give myself the best opportunity, which I couldn't do after the injury. Having it taken away from you, your dream, your whole career, being able to play in a World Cup, and then not play as much as I would have, as my ambition probably was to, and then to get it cut short, I was gutted. But I try not to sort of reflect too much on that when I think about my England career. I'm really trying hard to focus on the good memories that were made and be at peace with it as much as I can.
Just the last one on Exeter. They're quite a different team to the one that you used to play against the Wasps, with all the new guys, the young team. What have you made of them? Do you feel like they're dangerous in the fact that they're these young lads all kind of experiencing all this stuff for the first time, and they're going to have a crack? Like, you're obviously going to be favourites, aren't you, to beat them? So does that free them up almost to have a free shot?
Look, I think they did fantastically well against Bath and Exeter. One thing that I respect Exeter so much for is they've got a model that the way they play, and they are brilliant at it. That is the way they play. They don't change for anyone. They don't change week to week. They know how they play and they go after that. And I think you get some real clarity on the pitch with a game plan like that. And some of the signings they made this year, I think it's always hard for me as well. You see a couple of the young Wasps lads, you think sort of what could have been. But I'm chuffed for them. Well, you've got likes of Dan Frost down there. Manny Wabusu, have you seen how well he's been doing? And also
Greg Fizalau
as well. Yeah. So look, they're all great players, and they've got a lot of experience amongst that as well, with some great signings. So it's going to be an incredibly tough game this weekend, but I think boys are going to be incredibly up for it, as I know they will be, and yeah, it should be a good one to be part of.
Well, Jack, we really appreciate your time. Go well on Sunday against Exeter, and certainly from your point of view and Toulouse's point of view, hopefully you've got a few more matches still to go in this competition this year.
Thank you very much, guys. Great to chat.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So on to the Women's Six Nations. Had a rest week last week. It returns this coming weekend. Scotland against England, Ireland against Wales, and then it's France, Italy on Sunday. So Elgin, Scotland, let's start with the big rivalry with them against England. Scotland have had a really good start to the Six Nations. It always becomes a thing when then a team faces England. What's success for Scotland in coming up against the Red Roses?
I think the hopes they have are certainly more heightened now than it was 3 weeks ago because, yeah, like you say, they beat Wales in Cardiff, which has sort of cemented them as the best of the rest outside of England and France early doors. They gave France a real scare in that second round. It was only 8-5 until quite late on in the match, and then eventually France scored to win 15-5. As is always the case, you're just sort of looking at how close one of these teams can get to England. We talked last week about how Wales losing by 36 to them was actually quite a significant improvement in terms of points on previous years. And yet the fact that they had lost to Scotland meant that it diminished the achievement of that. So sort of again with Scotland, you're looking at them being competitive and limiting the scoreline. I think hopes of victory are probably a bit too far beyond because the gap historically is so large. But certainly they go into it with much more hope that they can keep it much below 50, which sort of tends to be the average victory by England in the matches against teams other than France in recent years.
And then huge game, Ireland, Wales, two sides without a win so far.
Yeah, I mean, it's really must win for Wales after losing that first two, because the absolute minimum expectation for this tournament was that they would beat Scotland, Ireland and Italy and, you know, possibly give France a real good go and then damage limitation against England. That opening defeat against Scotland, like I said, has just set them back so much. So it's absolutely must win for Wales. They really don't want to drop down, you know, to possibly fifth in the tournament, let alone fourth where they possibly are now. For Ireland, you know, they won the wooden spoon last year, so for them it's just a case of trying to get a win by any means possible.
And there was a massive outpouring on social media towards the back end of last week because Clee Maloney returning to the Ireland setup. She hasn't been involved for quite a while. She's been very vocal about a lot of the issues that many of our listeners will be well aware of in terms of the women's game in Ireland. But she is returning for the first time since then to the Ireland setup, which is great to see, and also great to see the reaction to that news.
Yeah, it was a really big talking point when the tournament launched. Scott Beamans, the new Ireland head coach, was asked about it quite a bit, and he said, you know, the door was open. For anyone who doesn't know, that the story is Clee Maloney, Exeter Chiefs hooker, criticised the IRFU Women's Director of Rugby, Anthony Eddy, for some comments he made suggesting that the Ireland Women's 15s programme hadn't been overlooked in 2021. She criticised that. She was part of a group of players who signed a letter to the government stating they'd lost trust and confidence in the IRFU. And she hadn't been picked since those matches in 2021, despite being a high-profile player, like I say, for Exeter Chiefs. over in England. When you look at what the Ireland players were talking about, you go back 10 years, Ireland won the Grand Slam in 2013. They beat New Zealand in the 2014 World Cup. They won the Six Nations again in 2015, albeit when England were focusing a bit more on sevens at the time. And since then, they've had that 15s dominance. But when you look at how the results compare now to 10 years ago, undoubtedly you can see so much how the Ireland results have dropped off a cliff. And that's why a win against Wales would be such a tick in the other direction now. And possibly, you know, Maloney can inspire that.
Classic PR. When did they drop that news?
Was it 4:59 p.m. on Friday?
Yeah. Oh, a squad update. Like one of the biggest women's news stories in recent memory. And Friday afternoon, let's put it there.
It still got picked up though, didn't
it? Oh yeah, of course.
My timeline was quite quickly full of people who were
But that is PR 101, isn't it? If you've got a story you don't want people to write about, put it on a Friday afternoon. But then some good journalists pick it up anyway, so good on those, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and great story there. And then just finally, France-Italy Sunday, routine French win. Is that what you're expecting? I still don't know with France. It, like they're winning, aren't they? And you still expect them to be the closest challengers to England. As we spoke about on last week's podcast, they don't look incredible.
All the traditional French men's cliches can now be transposed onto the women's team. You know, we saw it at WXV where they got revenge against New Zealand and then proceeded to lose to Australia. So they did have just enough to beat Scotland. You would absolutely expect them to win against Italy. And, you know, another high-profile venue there, like the men's team, moving around the country for their matches, and that's at the Stade Jean Bouin in Paris on Sunday. So it's a great location for the match.
Okay. It's freezing there. I've been there before to watch Stade Francais against the Lions, weirdly, last season. And their press box is very, very back of the stand. And it was, I don't think it was that cold today, but the wind whistling around the top of the stadium, I was in about nine layers and absolutely freezing. So hope everyone brings a coat who's going there.
I was
going
to say, that's Will's tips for the journalists that are making
or
the journey.
Or if you're sitting in the gods, you know.
Well, yeah, quite indeed. Well, we'll look back on the latest round of the Women's Six Nations in next week's podcast. Next up, the final part of this week's podcast, we will go through some any other business and we'll finish with our God or Goddess of the Week. So we mentioned earlier when we were talking about the Champions Cup and how we were going to try and have a bit of a conversation regarding the structure of the competition. I know Will's got some stuff on the proposed Club World Cup as well, which probably factors into all of this. But Elgin, it has been an issue, hasn't it, with the Champions Cup for a while now, the introduction of the South African teams and the travel issues that causes. Also, I think maybe culturally within South Africa, a few people have pointed out the attendances at the Bulls game. I think the attendance at the Stormers game was decent, but the game involving
the Bulls
wasn't
amazing. Was all right. They were expecting 60,000 across the two South African games, but the problem was, I think the camera and Loftus-Versfeld's on the wrong side, so it always looks like it's empty when actually the side that the camera's on is fairly full.
So it was better than...
And Loftus is 50,000 seater, so it's always going to look emptier.
Okay, fair enough.
But, yeah, I think it's still not quite... Again, it was something that John Dobson was saying the other day to me on the phone, is that he still doesn't think it's quite caught the South African imagination. And like, they're still, and maybe European fans would say, rightly so, hampered in so many ways. Like, if one of them makes a semi-final, they'll host it at the Stoop. They're not allowed to play a semi-final at home. If, like, there's not going to be a South African final for at least another couple of years, they're going to Cardiff and they're going to Bilbao. They haven't yet announced 2027, but I'd say possibly unlikely that it'd be in South Africa still. That Jake White, after the Bulls had won, was hoping that Munster would beat Northampton, because otherwise it means that his team are getting on seven or eight separate different flights to get to Northampton, to get to Heathrow, to get a bus up to Northampton, which is exactly what Stormers had to do last time. They'll only arrive on Tuesday, so they've only got a short time to travel
and then
over
it undermines
the tournament a bit. And yeah. However, that's what happens when you organise a cross-continental competition. You can't move South Africa 8,000 miles closer, so that's what has to happen, unfortunately. But there's a lot of teething things like that that makes this tournament not work quite as well as it used to.
But Elgin, have you got a silver bullet for us for the issues of structure in the domestic game?
Yeah, I've solved the entire thing in the space of 5 minutes.
Well done.
I would be in favour of a 32-team knockout tournament from the start, possibly with the first two rounds home and away, although as we've just discussed, with having South African teams involved, it makes it so difficult to... you know, do that home and away nature of matches. But that's one possible way I'd like to see it done. And then you could have 13 teams from the URC, 8 from the Premiership, 11 from the top 14. You could schedule it in such a way that the first round, there would be no sort of inter-country matches. Everyone would be playing teams they don't normally play in their league. And then thereafter, yes, just knock out the whole way through, which I think could be one way to make it, to improve the scheduling of the tournament.
So the news, I suppose, is that...
And this is why it won't work, by the way.
All I was going to say is that they are not going to change the format again next season. That's been quite clear from the leadership at EPCR. They're keen to make it work for a second season. And actually, seemingly, the Boffins have done the maths on the likelihood of these repeat fixtures happening between the pools and the last 16, and they reckon there was a 7% chance of that many, 5 out of 7 being repeats. So they want to basically try it again next season and see if it doesn't happen again, because they're not going to change the format for next season. But what is happening, as you flagged, is that in 4 years' time, we're going to have a Club World Cup, and then 4 years' time after that. So the way that would work, and people will be aware that this is happening, but basically the next bit of news on this is that essentially they've signed a memorandum of understanding, which sounds very posh, with the Southern Hemisphere teams to get this thing done. So in 2028 and 2032, so the year after the next two World Cups, the Champions Cup will pause at this stage with the 8 European and South African teams. Then the whole thing will stop. There'll be no European Cup winner for that season. Then that 8 will join in June, 6 Super Rugby teams plus 2 guests, likely to be from Japan, to make a sort of second last 16. You'd then have a 4-week Club World Cup where you go last 16, quarterfinal, semis, final. The first edition will be played in Europe. The second edition, let's see. You can imagine in years to come, the final could be held in somewhere brilliant like Saudi Arabia, that we'd all like to go to. And that's kind of how it would work. And the way they'd make the weeks work, would all the domestic competitions would finish by May, which, good luck telling the top 14 to cram it all in. They'll have to start the like 18 months earlier to get that done, maybe. But so that would leave June free for this Club World Cup. But it would break the kind of...
So it'd be in June, the Club World Cup.
4 weeks.
And then the usual international...
Would be July, the usual window.
Right.
So here's an interesting scenario for someone, a player. Let's say Finn Smith, for example, will be knocking around at high level at that time. So let's imagine his schedule. So in August of 2027, he'll play the World Cup warm-up games, then go through the World Cup in Australia, possibly play up to 7 matches there, come back, Christmas fixtures, the ones that the clubs love you to play in because they sell a lot of tickets for them. Six Nations, again, February, March 2028, then run in April, May, with a bit of Champions Cup group stage and stuff like that is already happening at that point. May, the end of the season, might win the league. June, you have a 4-week block where you're trying to win the Club World Cup, and then can you go and play 3 or 2 tests in South Africa? And don't play over 30 matches in the season, thanks.
And that seems... I think there are a whole heap of issues that we could pick out from what you just said there, but this always strikes me as the thing whenever we have these conversations, and it feels like it's the elephant in the room of how do we make the schedule work? And I just always look at other sports around the world of a comparable physicality to rugby, like the NFL, where the maximum amount of games you can play in a year is about 20 or something like that. The AFL, like the Aussie rules in Australia, which is a 6-month season. It starts in March, it ends in September. The NRL, I think, is about 24 games. Maybe there's playoffs, so that's a little bit longer. But it still comes down to the fact that rugby needs way less games, and it seems they're constantly adding them. And we're getting to the point where it will be an all round the year sport, as it kind of already is for the South African players because of how they.
Like next year, our year will run from September to August because of the Lions. Mm. The Lions ends in.
But it's kind of this issue that no one seems to be addressing. Like, surely, if you're a professional rugby player, you need to be playing what, 25 games in a year
as part of the next professional game agreement, which, let's see, will come in later this year. They want English players to play fewer matches. The recommendation at the moment is 30 equivalent matches, but they want that to reduce again. But again, it's always a battle. Like, who plays the players, the clubs? and they want them to play. Who has the most sort of significant matches, I suppose? So you're not arresting someone for a Six Nations game, are you? Or so, yeah, it always doesn't really work.
Well, I tell you what, get in touch. theruck@thetimes.co.uk. I would imagine that is a sort of issue that many of our listeners will want to get in touch about. So do drop us an email. We've got to quickly finish God or Goddess of the Week. I'll kick us off with Toby Booth from the Ospreys. We never speak too much about the Challenge Cup, but the Ospreys were the first European knockout victory. Really good win over Sale. They now play Gloucester in the quarterfinal this coming weekend. They're also seventh in the URC for all the issues and problems that are well documented that the Welsh regions are having. I think the job that Toby Booth is doing there at the Ospreys this season is pretty decent, and a great victory for them at the weekend. So he gets my vote. Elgin?
Very similar theme, although mine's an inanimate object. I was going for the Brewery Field in Bridgend, which the match, because Ospreys have had to play in Bridgend on New Year's Day because of a clash with the Swansea.com Stadium. This time they just thought, actually, went quite well, so we'll play Sale there as well. And the Ospreys are looking into a new ground because Swansea.com Stadium doesn't really work. It's just a bit soulless. So they're not going to be at the Brewery Field long term, but for that one game to be there, it was a great occasion and a great win.
I covered a game there once, like a British and Irish Cup game between Bristol and, I think, the Ospreys. It's a good old-fashioned spit and sawdust rugby ground, that. Will, God or Goddess of the Week?
Let's go for honourable mention to Will Evans for taking on the Scottish back row and winning, but let's go for George Hendy, as we mentioned before. Like, big ginger lad on the wing, scoring a good couple of tries. That was awesome to witness, so good on him.
Good on him. Well, enjoy all the rugby coming up this weekend. Women's Six Nations, quarterfinals, Challenge Cup, Champions Cup. We'll be back next Monday for an episode of The Ruck. In between now and then, make sure you follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcast from, and also leave us a review. We'll see you next week.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.